Good morning. Welcome to the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Manhattan. My name is Tom Phillips, and I'll be serving as your convener this morning. And as it says on the front of our program, our mission at UUFM is to be an evolving religious community where reason and intuition guide our personal journeys of spiritual and moral growth that call each of us to act for a better world. Whoever you are, whoever you love, you're welcome here. All right. I draw your attention to the announcements in our order of worship. I won't reread those for you. But also to remind those who are interested, at 12:15, the class will continue on continuing the name of Path to Membership. Yes, yeah, something about being a member of the Unitarian Universalist. 12:15 in the ALSOP room. Okay. Now, as is our custom, we will light the chalice, and I have Jake as a chalice lighter. And as he lights the chalice, let us think of these words. O flaming chalice, symbol of a free faith, burn with the holy oil of helpfulness and service. May we bring fuel for thy fire of love. May the oil of loving kindness flow from us to thy leaping flame. May hands of service shelter thee, that no winds of hate may extinguish thy brightness. May thy light and warmth be eternal. May we be keepers of thy flame. Now, stand as you're able and join in singing This Little Light of Mine.
We will sing all four verses. You'll notice that there are three, so you'll have to be alert.
Story for All Ages with John.
Yes. So come on up. Those of you who are young or young at heart are welcome to come up and hear the story from a close angle. That's a good spot, isn't it? So the story that I have for you today is from the Taoist tradition. Does anybody know where Taoism comes from? You don't know. Does anybody know? Does anybody know where Taoism comes from?
China.
China. Okay. Oh, you knew, didn't you? Oh, sorry. It has a little bit of a Chinese feel to it, doesn't it? And it's about a tree. And this is a good time of year to be thinking about trees because we're moving into autumn and things are going to be changing on the trees. I've even seen a few changed leaves. So do you have any favorite kinds of trees? Two big giant pine trees. We have a great tree out here, too. But the tree that I want... Oh, you have a favorite tree? Apple trees. Yeah, because you're going to get apples from them. You have a favorite tree? Oak trees. This is a story about an oak tree. It's a special kind of an oak tree. Yes? Purple trees. Yeah, those are really good. But this is a special kind of an oak tree. And this is a story about Carpenter Shee. Carpenter Shee was a master carpenter. He could make anything. He could build boats. He could build furniture. He could build coffins. He could build anything out of wood. And he and his apprentice were out. I'm telling the story now. We'll talk later. Okay. We'll talk later. But he and his apprentice were out wandering through the woods looking for good wood to make things into. So they were wandering through the forest and they came to this colossal oak tree. I mean, colossal. It would make this tree, it would be just in its shadow. If you had an ox, you could hide it behind this tree. This tree, the canopy of leaves was so huge that there were people gathering under it. There were children playing. There were people who had set up market stalls and were selling things under this tree. It was so huge. And the apprentice was just like, wow, wow. And Carpenter Shee just walked right on by like he didn't even notice. And the apprentice said, are you going to look at this great tree? I mean, what you could make out of this tree? Carpenter Shee said, that's a useless tree. That's a useless tree. It's all knotty. It's crooked. If you made a boat out of it, it would sink. If you made a coffin out of it, it would rot. If you made furniture out of it, it would fall apart. It's a useless tree. There's no point in even looking at it. So they went on through the woods, and Carpenter Shee went home, and he went to bed that night, and he had a dream. And in the dream, the tree came to him. And the tree said, let me tell you about useless. Now, if I were a fruit tree, if I were an apple tree, people would be all over me. They would be breaking off my boughs. They would be pulling the fruit off. They would be making nicks in me all the time. It would be amazing if I could survive. If I were one of these straight trees you're talking about, without any knots or anything like that, I would have been cut down a long time ago and made into something else. But I am a glorious, huge oak tree, and you are a useless carpenter. And so, this whole idea of usefulness from the tree and uselessness all becomes a little bit more in perspective as Carpenter Shee learned in his dream. And so you all can go on to your classes.
Now comes the time for each of us, if we choose, to talk about any joys or concerns you might have this morning. We have a microphone. We're willing to pass it around. Okay, we have Chris, then Dick.
Good morning, Chris Bailey. Me again, sorry. The latest concern is also not an emergency, but... In preparation for bicycling for 2 weeks in Italy, starting next week, my mother and Larry were riding their bikes to Zinedale and back, and we're almost home when Larry took a spill. And so he's got some road rash, and he's a little banged up, and there might be an injured rib involved. We haven't heard. But so just think about Larry, who's got a long plane ride ahead of him and may have to stay in the van for the bicycle tour. But
joy for everybody here. Don't miss the total eclipse of the moon tonight. Perfectly clear weather predicted. It's going to be awesome. Go out and look at it around maybe 9:30, 10. Anna.
Hi. Day before yesterday, I drove my car for the first time. I was able to use my left hand to turn the ignition, which was really a contortion. I'm glad I'm a yogi. I don't plan to do too much driving, but I just want to say thank you to everyone, so many of you who have been giving me rides for like the past, 2 months or something. Thank you. That's my joy.
Hi, I just wanted to thank, Inel Forrester, is she here, and other people that are in the League of Women Voters. They were able to register, I think, around 300 people on their big registering day last week, so that brought me a lot of joy.
Anybody else? Okay, so for all those joys and concerns we hear and for those we hold in our hearts, let us be thoughtful on those. All right. Offering is next, and the Unitarian Universalism is a grand vision of a world filled with peace and justice, love and joy. Each one of you, by your commitment of your time, energy, and resources, helps make that grand vision real. Individually and together, we are UUs, building a world filled with peace and justice, love and joy. The offering will now be given and gratefully received. Thank you, Renee. Before we sing our next hymn, I've been asked to read these thoughts from Richard Gilbert, a retired Unitarian Universalist minister, titled, "To Savor the World or Save It." I rise in the morning torn between the desire to save the world or to savor it, to serve life or to enjoy it, to savor the sweet taste of my own joy or to share the bitter cup of my neighbor, to celebrate life with exuberant step or to struggle for the life of the heavy laden. What am I to do when the guilt at my bounty clouds the sky of my vision, when the glow which lights my every day illumines the hurting world around me? To savor the world or save it. God of justice, if such there be, take from me the burden of my question. Let me praise my plenitude without limit. Let me cast from my eyes all troubled folk. No, you will not let me be. You will not stop my ears to the cries of the hurt and the hungry. You will not close my eyes to the sight of the afflicted. What's that you say? To save, one must serve. To savor, one must save. The one will not stand without the other. Forgive me in my preoccupation with myself, in my concern for my own life, I had forgotten. Forgive me, God of justice. Forgive me and make me whole. John Liu is going to teach us a new hymn.
Yeah. Our music director.
We've got a group that's going to teach it.
Scattered around through the room. Everybody should be fairly close to one. It's in three parts, so you can be whichever one you want. Let's see. We'll do the first one, the one at the very bottom, because it's the easiest, and you can see what that's like. Just give us our two C's. Somebody can sing this C up here. Somebody can sing it down here. All right. Breathe in, breathe out, breathe in, breathe out, breathe in, breathe out, breathe in, breathe out. Okay, now then, the lead verse is the one that's in the on the top score of the score. All right. Right.
I'll breathe in peace when I breathe out. I'll breathe out love when I breathe in. I'll breathe in peace when I breathe out. I'll breathe out love
once more
when I breathe in. I'll breathe out peace when I breathe out. I'll breathe out love.
Then there is what's called a descant part, which is high but not very high here. Let's see. We have two people who will lead it, and you can sing with that if you want to. All right? So we go one, two, three, four, one.
When I breathe in, I'll breathe in peace. When I breathe in, I'll breathe out love. When I breathe in, when I breathe out, I'll breathe out love.
Got it? Okay, all right. So, first time through, just us people who can do the simple part are doing it. And a couple here on the bottom line. Breathe in, breathe in, breathe out, breathe in. Okay, we'll do that first. Then next we'll come in the main thing, and then we'll come in the descant part. Why don't you stand up? No. Please stand up. I forgot. I taught seventh grade. You never ask a question that can be answered more than one way, right? Okay.
Breathe in, breathe out. Breathe in, breathe out. Breathe in. Breathe out.
first time, not too bad. Thanks.
When I breathe in, I'll breathe in peace. When I breathe out, I'll breathe out love. The cycle of breathing in and out is so basic to life that we rarely even think about it. We just breathe. Sometimes we breathe deeply in a relaxed and centered way, and sometimes, particularly as emotions overcome us, we breathe shallowly, engaging only the tiniest upper part of our lungs. The ancient Taoist masters asserted that dying people breathe from their throats, and most people breathe from their chests, and the student of Tai Chi breathes from deep in the belly, and the master breathes from the feet. Breathing connects all life. We take in oxygen and release carbon dioxide, while plants do the opposite. So we support one another's life. The breath we exchange today consists of bits of matter that have been around since the beginning of time and move through us, giving us moment after moment of vitality. Breathing, from a scientific perspective or a spiritual perspective, keeps us alive. What's more, there's a pattern to breathing. In and out. In and out. A pattern that may speak to other basic human needs to draw in reflection and move out in action. And that is the theme of this morning's sermon. Now, here's the presenting problem. To engage in the social justice work that our beliefs and values require can be exhausting. Last week, I visited the teen class where one of their exercises was to think about a belief, the value it represented, and the action that came out of that, which is really a very demanding exercise, thinking through all of that. If I believe in the inherent worth and dignity of every person and value people for their humanity rather than anything else, what does that mean I must do in how I treat them? Take that belief and value and add it to all my other beliefs and values, and I've got a lot of stuff to work on. What am I going to do about my carbon footprint, about racism, about the promotion of education, about inequality in the justice system? The list goes on and on. We can so easily burn out. We can also get frustrated, not only with the forces that resist social change, but sometimes with our own allies who argue over strategy or who disappoint us because they don't show up when they said they would. The work can be draining and seem impossible. It can even drain us when we're not even engaged in it. Simply watching the news, seeing the refugees streaming across Europe, mourning the dead on the pilgrimage to Mecca, tallying up the body count in warfare or in the justice system. Just getting informed can paralyze because we can't figure out what to do or how. What's more, there's not enough time. Climate change has already had such an effect that we fear ever being able to reverse it. The Black Lives Matter struggle can't seem to move quickly enough to save the next life. The children will be grown before we get the schools turned around. Are you breathing a little more shallowly yet as I recite the litany? The chaos and brokenness of the world draws us toward action and repels us at the same time, pushing us to close our eyes and refuse to see what's going on. We want to make a difference, and yet we want to protect ourselves. Our lives are already full. caring for our own families, whether racing to soccer matches or squeezing in that visit to an elderly relative we're worried about, or both. It can fill the day and night. Where's the room for changing the world? Thomas Merton, the Catholic monastic writer who was lifted up by the Pope during his talk to Congress this week, wrote in 1965 in Conjectures of a Guilty Bystander. Is that a great title or what? Conjectures of a Guilty Bystander. He wrote this: "There is a pervasive form of contemporary violence to which the idealist most easily succumbs: activism and overwork. The rush and pressure of modern life are a form, perhaps the most common form, of its innate violence. To allow oneself to be carried away by a multitude of conflicting concerns, to surrender to too many demands, to commit oneself to too many projects, to want to help everyone in everything is to succumb to violence. The frenzy of our activism neutralizes our work for peace. It destroys our own inner capacity for peace. It destroys the fruitfulness of our work because it kills the root of inner wisdom, which makes work fruitful. The frenzy of our activism kills the root of inner wisdom, which makes our work fruitful." It's like trying to breathe out all the time without breathing in again. We have to ground our social activism in something. Yes, we research and study to ensure we understand the issues and have goals that are doable and constructive and won't have unintended consequences that set off other problems. That's an intellectual grounding. But we need more than that. We need a spiritual grounding. Without a spiritual grounding, we risk losing our moral high ground. Gary Peluso-Verdend, the president of Phillips Theological School, a Disciples of Christ seminary, wrote a blog post explaining how journalists were getting the Pope wrong by describing his messages as political. Many of us, when we hear the Pope decry climate change and capital punishment, cheer him on, but from a political perspective rather than the religious and spiritual perspective from which he is actually speaking. Similarly, we attack our disagreements politically. As Peluso-Verdend puts it, partisan political discourse has trumped and superseded religious, spiritual, and moral discourse in public, as well as often in churches. In contrast, he says, the Pope is doing what a Christian religious leader should do. He is speaking from a theologically, biblically, and moral tradition-informed center to a broken world. No, I do not agree with him on all of his interpretations. But neither will I label him as too liberal or too conservative or too political as a way of dismissing the deep theological, biblical, and moral reasoning he's bringing to bear. So, obviously, we are not in the same religious boat with the Pope, or even the disciples of Christ. But it is helpful to remember that our social justice stances and action need to be grounded in something more than politics. Rather, in a worldview, beliefs and principles that champion values, justice, compassion, reason, tolerance, celebration of diversity. And to ground ourselves that way, we need to turn to the inner life, the spiritual life. Now, it has not escaped my attention that the very word spiritual gets reactions around here that are not always positive. So some of that reaction seems to be a lack of understanding. I don't know what you mean by spiritual, and that's fair enough. And part of the reaction also seems to be dismissive of the need for spirituality. So I'm going to start with the meaning. If you look in the dictionary for spirit, you find a really long list of definitions, including at least one that involves alcohol, which is interesting in itself. But Some of the definitions are not just mysterious, but downright contradictory. For example, while some dictionaries define spirit as soul, other authorities draw lines of distinction between the spirit and the soul. It's all very confusing. No wonder people don't know what we mean when we use the word. Its meaning is elusive because what it tries to describe is elusive. But elusive does not mean unreal. Like the air that moves in and out of our lungs and cannot be seen, spirit is invisible. The root of the word spirit derives from the breath. Spiritus in Latin means breath. Similarly, in Greek, the word pneuma means breath, but also means the spirit, just as the Hebrew word ruach can mean wind, breath, or spirit. We're back to the breath again. In and out, animating life. For me, the spiritual is that elusive and invisible something which creates life and meaning in and around me. Part of spirituality is connecting me to what's going on in my own body, in my own mind, in my own emotions, in my own thoughts. And part of it is connecting me to what's going on around me, observing the weather, the emotional tenor of the room, the spoken and unspoken words or needs that soar and spin around me. Being able to observe and withhold judgment. Spirit is also what Richard Gilbert was talking about in the reading this morning, where he experiences that pull to savor the world. Spirituality involves awareness, mindfulness, choicefulness. So often in our lives, we slip unaware into reaction or habit, keeping ourselves from full freedom, responding instead to our programming. Spirituality opens up the opportunity for freedom. We may be unable to choose in this moment what is happening to us. We may be unable to choose even our emotions or thoughts that are in reaction to what's happening to us. But spirituality equips us to choose what we say or do in each moment, despite the circumstances we are in. It allows us to free ourselves both from the outer circumstances and from our own thoughts and emotions, because it invites us into perspective, gratitude, curiosity, and wonder. Spirituality gives us the longing to be integrated rather than fragmented as a human being, to know ourselves and the world at a deeper level, to let go of what is unhelpful in our lives, and to move intentionally. In short, spirituality invites us to change. And change is exactly what the work for social justice is about, except it's usually about changes outside ourselves instead of inside. But if we really believe in the interconnected web of all existence, then we understand that change outside ourselves can either require or result in change inside ourselves. Take, for example, the challenge of climate change, decreasing our carbon footprint. I remember more than a decade ago spending a fair amount of time and energy collecting signatures in Oklahoma City on a petition pushing for bike racks on the front of buses. A small step, but something the city could clearly do without a whole lot of resources. And my memory says it was actually in a plan, you know, one of those plans that they make and then set on the shelf and may or may not do. Anyway, those plans that sometimes don't go anywhere. So we were doing these signature collections. And the fact that I had been on an Oklahoma City bus maybe once and that I was not a frequent bike rider did not keep me from valiantly pushing for a city policy that I was really pretty unlikely ever to use. But it was the right thing, and it would benefit a political group that I was working with. What it also did, though, was get me in touch with other people who at least occasionally rode bikes. And I got invited to a critical mass event where a group of bike riders would take to the road downtown at rush hour, demonstrating the challenges of sharing the roads with bikes and basically causing chaos. It was great fun, and I did it a bunch of times. And it changed me. Riding with critical mass gave me the courage to ride through the city at other times. I began riding more and more, not just for recreation and exercise, but for transportation. On my old, decrepit little Schwinn Suburban that I still ride, I grew into a bike rider. Behaving more consistently with my values, decreasing my use of gasoline, and part of it was taking time to reflect on what I was doing and saying and making real choices. And I have to say, this didn't feel at all like a deprivation. Oh, I shouldn't drive when I'm doing bike advocacy. Rather, it felt like I was freeing myself from the dominant car-based mindset. I stopped automatically hopping in the car to go to the drugstore or post office or church as I realized that riding wouldn't take that much longer and actually made me feel better connecting with the world around me more closely, feeling the wind and sun on my face, and my body working instead of cooped up in a car in my own tiny little world. I'm reminded of Reverend Osagyefu Uhuru Seku, a Black activist who asks, "How do you have joy?" as a part of his work for social justice. Joy. Joy is part of the grounding in spirituality. And as a bonus, I get to be more consistent with my values. My social activism reflected on led me to change myself in ways that made me a more integrated, more joyful, and choiceful person. Paul Raiser, a UU theologian who is white, writes about dealing with racism. Yes, we need to notice the facts that alert us to the continued presence of racism in our society and education, in the justice system, and in the workplace. But he claims that racism is not only structural and institutional, but also spiritual. He writes this: "All of our analysis, no matter how sophisticated, and all of our programs, no matter how well designed, will never be sufficient by themselves to make us anti-racist. We must also be willing to do the difficult soul work necessary for spiritual transformation. This aspect of our task reveals an ambivalence for religious liberals. As much as we say we want more spirituality in our lives, we're often reluctant to go deep to find it. Part of this is no doubt due to our traditional emphasis on rationality, which many of us erroneously place in opposition to spirituality. Another factor is an awareness that sustained spiritual practice can take us deep inside, exposing aspects of ourselves that we might rather not see. We lose the security of safe distance that purely intellectual analysis permits. We've been shaped by the very powers and structures we now want to dismantle. The social transformation we seek requires spiritual transformation as well. Without this, our anti-racism work, like other prophetic practice for social change, becomes difficult to sustain or retreats into the safety of disengaged analysis or internal debate." So that's what my friend Paul says. And as he says, it's not just about the issue of racism, but any prophetic practice for social change. We have to change because we have been shaped by what it is that we want to change. And the only way to do that is with the discipline of spirituality. Here's another way of thinking about it, far less abstract and more visual. It's a short video from a student, Sunshine Maria, on art as social action. But I think you'll see the tie-in to what I call the spirit. Maria shows us the state of emergency in the world, but juxtaposes images of problems with those of people working to confront those problems. And she leaves us with hope as expressed through art and through spirit. There are images of meditation, of incense burning, of prayer, which is the other role I believe spirituality plays here. It can give us the strength and courage to keep up the work to which we are called. What's more, this balance of in-breath and the out-breath, spirit and action, applies not only in social action, but in everything we do in our lives, because it's all about knowing what it is we have to do and making choices. If we work too hard without the infusions of joy and the grounding in spiritual reflection, we risk becoming brittle, angry, and bitter. On the other hand, if we withdraw into the spiritual alone, we become navel gazers or narcissists not contributing to the world. There are times in all of our lives when our focus will be more on action or more on reflection. And as a young person, I was ready to tear the world up to make it better. And in retrospect, I realized I pushed too hard in ways that hurt others and that really weren't worth it. But part of that is the idealism of youth gone astray. I take responsibility, but don't hold on to guilt about it. Instead, I have learned and grown. So, before I bring this to a close, are there questions or comments or thoughts that we want to engage with? Doug has a microphone.
Thank you so much. I feel as though you have articulated such an important thing that we all need to think about and given us a lot to think about. And you've done it really beautifully. So thank you.
Well, thank you. Really? Nobody has anything to say? Oh, there.
You're just talking about how natural reactions people have to terms like spirituality. And I guess for me, sometimes I get kind of this fear that comes up because sometimes I feel like it's used to like blanket people into groups that they don't identify with. Like, I'm personally an atheist, and so sometimes people kind of express this idea of, well, you're an atheist, but of course you believe this, or of course you believe that. And it's just kind of, you know, sometimes used in an insulting way, like saying you don't really believe what you believe. But I feel like what you're talking about is something that I can relate to also. And it's hard to get over that hurdle of using the term spirituality, but I kind of think of it almost as like an emergent property of consciousness, I guess, if that makes sense. So,
yeah, an emergent, that was a good phrase. I liked that phrase, an emergent property of consciousness. That's good. I knew somebody who used to like to use the word consciousness rather than spirituality, and that works. Consciousness. Any other questions or thoughts or comments? Oh, Anna wants to talk again.
Okay. You know, I apologize for talking too much, but I really feel as though the word spirituality to most people is very threatening, in particular to our individual ego. And it's also brings up images of emotion. And it also, as you were saying in your speech, brings us into a place where we may see things about the world or maybe even about ourselves that we really don't want to have to deal with. I think that getting clear about what spirituality is and what it is to be in touch with that about ourselves that's invisible, like our emotions and our thoughts that are so easy to ignore unless we sort of put them into a scientific or logical form. It's just very, very difficult for people to go to that place, and it's kind of scary. And I'll just give you one example of something that happened to me. And I don't think of myself as one who's afraid of spiritual awareness. I went to, I won't say which church, but I went to a church, a Christian church, a couple of times. And I really enjoyed the music. I enjoyed the people. They were all beautiful and lovely. And it was a very Christian service with readings from the Bible by people who really believe. And although I can't say that I totally really believe, I found that being amongst them brought me to tears. Just being there in the room with all those people who were sincerely looking into what is it that makes me the way I am, what not only I'm right about this because I want peace and justice, but what is it that I might be doing wrong? And I think the ego is very much threatened by a deep, sincere inner seeking, spiritual seeking. And I think that's a problem.
That piece of the of spirituality and ego, that is one of the classic struggles in various religious traditions. I mean, it comes up in the Eastern traditions as well as the Western traditions. And we do want to preserve ourselves, and that's legitimate and fine. But how do we get to the place of really feeling that interconnection with the world if we're completely protective of our own ego? It's a major thing. Sabrina?
Well, I'm sometimes wondering if some people equate spirituality with religious, because some people say they're religious, you're like, ugh. But if you're spiritual, some people prefer to say spiritual because it's more of an inner dive, so to speak, going inside of yourself. And I think spiritual is a better word because you're more like looking into what's inside of you instead of what other people are doing.
Yeah. Spiritual and religion, that's a whole big thing of separating, you know, how we view that. Because, I mean, to me, religion means within a specific tradition that has been handed down. Spiritual need not be within a tradition, but can be within a tradition. Yeah.
Matt Campbell. Coming from someone that has chosen to not be spiritual, so I find myself on a new mission to find. So I think I got on that path because I was not finding the right spirituality, but now I'm on a mission. So now I'm on a track with finding new spirituality, and what does that mean? So I really appreciate this talk. And with that, there's two things that really resonate with me. Is one is becoming interconnected with all aspects of your life. I find that very spiritual. And the second is living out your values. So living with purpose and living to your values, I find very spiritual and uplifting and joyful.
Yeah.
So thank you.
Good.
Gene Severs. I wouldn't dare try to define the totality of spirituality, but I think it's something that's personal to every individual. And yet at the same time, it's almost a hope that it can help explain how people of disparate thinking and beliefs can still find some interconnectedness and relate to each other for a greater cause and almost a hopefulness.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm sort of thinking out loud, and you're talking about breathing in. I'm Sylvia Beeman. I'm thinking about what you were saying about breathing in and out. Does expire mean breathe out also? Mm-hmm. So inspire, that means breathing in. So isn't that a neat little connection there?
Inspiration is taking in, yeah.
So we inspire oxygen, which is a necessity. So that makes me think of all those implications that we need. We need, just like oxygen, some deeper thing that drives us, or your life feels so empty. Mm-hmm. I heard this Native American elder yesterday, and in their tradition, they always talk about spirit, mind, and body. Mm-hmm. And so I hadn't really finished thinking about that. So you've given me some clues of how to understand what he was saying. But also, I had this really good friend, and I met her through my two younger daughters, because she had two kids their age, but she had six kids, and she'd actually been pregnant 12 times to have those six kids, and she was very, very fundamentalist Christian, and we had so much fun together. Mm-hmm. We laughed so hard together, and we realized, even though we voted against each other every single time, and some of our beliefs were 180 degrees opposite, we still wanted the same things in our lives. We sought the same things. And for our kids. And they send us a Christmas newsletter every year. And now their Christmas newsletter picture, each of their kids has about six kids. Mm-hmm. But my youngest daughter always makes me save it so we can read it out loud together. Mm-hmm. I find them very inspiring. Although my mind under my spirit, between my body and my spirit, is telling me, what about overpopulation? Mm-hmm. But I always thought if anyone was meant to have six kids, it was certainly this person. And her kids are all wonderful, really, really wonderful.
Mm-hmm. So connection really, that's a piece of it. Connection, I think, is a really important piece of spirituality, yeah. I thought I'd seen another hand. Yeah.
Yeah, I guess I've never really had a whole lot of trouble with thinking of the term spirituality, because I'm not a religious person, but I think that the spirit is what either draws or repels us, you know, to other people. And I think that, you know, we're going to get to the point where actually scientific research is going to be able to quantify this more. I always wondered, you know, what it is that when I look at my children, what is it that makes my chest feel warm, you know, and makes my heart beat a little faster? You know, and science has now told us, you know, that it's the release of oxytocin, and there's dopamine and serotonin and all those other things that are happening. And I can get that same feeling if I hear a particularly beautiful piece of music. And I remember being here one time and hearing Slavomir play a piece, and there was no words, but I bawled my eyes out because the music was so intensely sad. Mm-hmm. And it was affecting my spirit. And that's the way that I think of it. You know, I don't have to put any religious connotation, but it's what connects me with everything else in the world.
Mm-hmm. Lovely. Anyone else? I want to close with another reading from Thomas Merton that demonstrates to me his acquaintance with Buddhism, because he was a Catholic priest, but he also had delved into Buddhist practice. And his words give us, I think, a spiritual perspective for doing work in the world, that sometimes this is a perspective that might not make sense without a spiritual connotation to it. But he writes, "Do not depend on the hope of results. You may have to face the fact that your work will be apparently worthless and even achieve no result at all." I think about the useless tree here. if not perhaps results opposite to what you expect. As you get used to that idea, you start more and more to concentrate not on the results, but on the value, the rightness, the truth of the work itself. Gradually, you struggle less and less for an idea and more for specific people, because in the end, it is the reality of personal relationships that saves everything. Or as Wes Jackson of the Land Institute says, if your life's work can be accomplished in your lifetime, you're not thinking big enough. Our closing hymn is number 298, Wake Now My Senses. Our dreams be big enough. May we have the grounding and inspiration to work steadily toward them, even if they remain unfulfilled. And may we find in our work in the world connection, joy, and gratitude to fill our lives. So may it be.
Oh.